So I'm here in Minneapolis and at the Weston Price Conference with the president of Weston Price Foundation, Sally Fallon Morrell.
That's correct.
And so Sally, tell me a little bit about Weston Price Organization, what it is, and your role in it.
So, the Weston A. Price Foundation is named after Weston A. Price, who was a dentist. And he traveled in the 30s and 40s to remote corners of the planet to study people who had never eaten anything but their own food. And he wanted to answer the question, what is a healthy diet? What kind of diet gives us good dental health? He was a dentist. That means no cavities and naturally straight teeth, good facial structure, and good overall health. So robust physical health, freedom from disease, ease of reproduction, and painless childbirth.
And he went a lot of places, right?
Yes, he went to a lot of places, and in the end, he found 14 groups that he could say were superbly healthy, with virtually no tooth decay, no dental deformities. Now, that means crooked teeth. That part he could count and measure and look at and write scientific articles on. But he also just observed and observed that the people were extremely robust and seemed to be immune to disease, and it was really struck. In fact, many people in the early days of these explorations were struck at how easy childbirth was for these women. It wasn't something that you dreaded and that was painful. It just, the typical Eskimo woman, for example, gave birth at night while her husband was asleep, and when he woke up in the morning, she introduced him to the new baby. So he found 14 people, excuse me, 14 groups that he considered superbly healthy. But we still have this question, what is a healthy diet? You know, we had groups, the Eskimos living in the Arctic, no plants at all in their diet, and a lot of fermented fish and walrus and seal and things like that. And then you had the South Seas, where they lived on fish and pork and a lot more plant foods. You had the Andes, you had Maoris in New Zealand. He also looked at Swiss people. He found an isolated Swiss group living on grains and cheese. And then he found a group in the Outer Hebrides living on fish and grains, oats for the grain.
So it was the first criteria that they have good dental health
Yes.
and traditional diets, or basically just good dental health, and then let's see what they're eating.
Exactly, that what it was. He found the good dental health. He left a fantastic record of cavities, how many cavities were in these traditional groups. So all the diets were different, and a lot of people just throw up their hands and say, well, there's no such thing as a healthy diet. But he looked further. What he found was that whatever they were eating, whether it was quinoa or, you know, corn or whatever, the diets were very nutrient dense. There were a lot of vitamins and a lot of minerals, and there were especially high levels of the vitamins that we get from animal fats, certain types of seafood, organ meats, butter from pastured cows, and eggs from birds outside.
So the fat-soluble
The
vitamins.
fat-soluble vitamins, he called them fat-soluble activators because you can't actually absorb the minerals in these mineral-rich foods unless you have these activators. And so you hear us say these words a lot, fat-soluble activators. So it's vitamin A, vitamin D, and vitamin K2. And I would say that our organization has been in the forefront of the research to understand these vitamins and even test them in food.
And K2 is kind of more of a recent understanding of what it was, right?
Absolutely. We say that there's a vitamin hit parade, okay? So in the early days, vitamin A was at the top of the hit parade because it was the first vitamin discovered, and it's a very, very important vitamin.
Thus, A.
Vitamin A has fallen to the bottom of the hit parade. It's considered toxic by mainstream medicine. Vitamin D has come to the top of the hit parade, and people are taking huge doses of synthetic vitamin D, which is absolutely not a good idea. Nobody had even talked about vitamin K 20 years ago. It was only for blood clotting. But the animal form of vitamin K, which is K2, which is in these certain foods. It's in things like goose fat and duck fat. It's in lard. It's in animal fats. It's in organ meats. And it's also in natto, which is a fermented soy product. But anyway, and it's in cheese, which is great to know. We now know that vitamin K is just an essential vitamin. What vitamin K does is keep calcium in the right place. So it keeps the calcium in your bones and teeth, so they'll be very resistant to decay. And it keeps the calcium out of your soft tissues like your arteries and your heart. So all these years, the...
Because that's a lot of what arteriosclerosis is.
Yeah, it's calcium in your arteries, yes. Or and arthritis is calcium in your joints. I think you could say there's calcium in your brain for dementia. So it's kind of ironic. All these years we've been told that not to eat things like cheese and animal fats because they'll give you heart disease. And yet these are the very foods that contain the vitamin K that is highly protective of heart disease. So it's kind of ironic.
So you got involved with the Weston Price Organization. As a matter of fact, you founded it, correct?
Yes. So I had read Weston Price's book in the 70s, and my family was just coming along. I had one child, and three more came along after that. And I loved to cook. I always loved to cook. I loved butter and eggs and, you know, I loved rich foods. And when I read Dr. Price's book, it was just at the time when this low-fat message was getting pretty strident. And reading his book convinced me that I was actually on the right path. This is how I should feed my children. And so my children grew up on a very rich diet. Lots of cream, butter. I've kind of hid the liver in a lot of foods. They were much healthier than I was. None of them needed braces to straighten their teeth, and I needed braces. Their eyesight was better than mine. None of them had the kind of allergies that I had. So I had convinced myself that this is the right way to go. In the meantime, this low-fat diet was started to be imposed on growing children. In 1990, National Cholesterol Education Program added the provision that children at the age of 2 should be put on what's called the prudent diet, which is low in fat, you know, no butter, skim milk, low cholesterol in the diet. And I knew this was wrong. I knew this was terribly wrong and would have disastrous results. It was in 1990, actually, the same year that these new guidelines came in. It's funny how the universe works. I had this idea to write the cookbook, Nourishing Traditions, that would put Dr. Price's findings into practical form, because his book is a bit hard to read. It's a bit put-offing.
And what was the name of his book?
His book is Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. So I started writing the book, and along the way I met Dr. Mary Enig, who was a lipid research scientist, because I didn't understand the science very well. And she kept me on the right path. She said, your conclusions are right, but you need to explain them properly. And we worked together on the book and eventually became co-authors. And when the book came out, we then decided that we needed something more, because we were just being bombarded with propaganda against animal fats and for the vegetable oils and for the processed foods.
And margarine,
yes, and spreads, and there was this big campaign to get the tallow out of the French fries, and tallow is the right fat for frying. It's very safe, and they ended up frying in partially hydrogenated vegetable oil. So that's when we decided to set up the Weston A. Price Foundation. We felt we really had a mandate to get this information to the public, and particularly to people of childbearing age.
When you said we, you mean you?
No, Mary and I, it was my husband and a few other people, Dr. Tom Cowan. And we just felt that it was urgent to get this message out. And over the years, the Weston A. Price Foundation has focused on preconceptual diets, diets during pregnancy, lactation, and the growth of children. Because what Dr. Price found was every culture had certain sacred foods that were very high in vitamins and minerals that they ate in preparation for conception and then during pregnancy, during lactation, and during the growth of the children. Because that's when the body is formed. Once you become an adult, you can't go back and fix your narrow face or your poorly formed lungs or your not very dense bones or whatever, porous bones. You have to do it during that period of growth. And that primitive people understood this. If they had an unhealthy child, they knew it was their fault. When a unhealthy child is born today, we blame it on the three G's: genes, germs, and God. Okay? It's genetic, or it's some kind of infection, or it's God's will. And I don't buy that. It's not God's will that any unhealthy child is born on this planet.
Well, let's get the food right first, and then we can decide.
Yeah, right, right.
So native people understood you need super nutrition when you're in your critical moments of your kid's development and growth.
Forming the child and when the child grows. And let me give you a very good example. We now know that vitamin A is the constant master of fetal development. I use that phrase. So when the embryo starts to grow and divide, it's composed of stem cells. These are undifferentiated cells. And the stem cells then start to become heart cells or lung cells or bone cells, whatever. What tells them what to do? It's vitamin A. And if you get pregnant and don't have enough vitamin A stored in your system, those stem cells will not get the right signals or enough signals. And so the heart may not form, and the mother has a miscarriage, or the heart is formed with a defect. And this is true throughout the gestation period. Recent research indicates that the vitamin A status of the mother determines how many kidney cells you'll have and whether you'll have a good, robust, healthy kidney. So all of a sudden we see the fantastic scientific validation for what Price discovered, that these people, 6 months before pregnancy, ate foods like liver and animal fats that were extremely rich in vitamin A. So you build up those vitamin A stores, and then when you do get pregnant, you have what you need for the ideal, optimal division of the cells into the organs, or the transformation of the stem cells into the organs.
Yeah, but modern medicine now understands that. So they've come up with GMO rice that has a synthetic vitamin A added, right?
What's in plant foods is not vitamin A. I know the FDA allows the food company to say that spinach and oranges have vitamin A in them. They do not have vitamin A in them. They have carotenes. And we can convert the carotenes into vitamin A sometimes. About 47% of the population lacks the enzyme to do this at all. So we have almost half the population doesn't make this conversion. But it's something that's hard for human beings to do. And even under optimal circumstances, you cannot make enough vitamin A from carrots or spinach to meet your requirements. You need it from the nutrient-dense animal foods like liver. And liver was a sacred food in many cultures. The pregnant women ate liver. It was the first weaning food for babies. So you can see that our message is, we just think this is urgent. We have such a health crisis with our children today. We need to teach moms how to have healthy babies. And I can tell you that our formula works. We've seen healthy baby after healthy baby, happy, intelligent, strong children who grow normally and grow tall and strong and smart and good dispositions when they follow this diet.
So you basically, with a few other committed people, started this organization in 99?
Yes, in 1999, we published a quarterly journal that goes to our members, and that first one was in spring of 2000.
And your journal is called?
Our journal is called Wise Traditions, and we pride ourselves on appealing both to the scientist and practitioner as well as to the layman. Front part of the journal is a lot of science, the latest in nutrition. We've had some really cutting-edge articles there. And then the back part of the journal is a little bit more laid back. We have cooking articles, practical articles on bringing up children. We always have articles on farming and gardening. and on what's going on in the politics of agriculture as well.
And then you have this conference once a year.
This conference is once a year, and we do occasionally put on local one-day conferences as well.
And you have a remarkable website that's a great resource, WestonAPrice.org, correct?
Yes, WestonAPrice.org is a huge website, which we've just revised. It looks beautiful, and a good search engine. So if you're looking for anything to do with health, you go and put it in the search engine. Just say you want to know how to deal with gout, for example. You put gout in there and you'll come up with some articles about gout and the latest research on gout, which, by the way, is not caused by proteins, but a high-carb diet. And I guarantee you that what you find on our website will not be the same as what you find on WebMD. I guarantee you.
So you basically started this organization after Dr. Price had died, right?
Yes, Dr. Price died in 1948, and his book has been in print ever since that time. There's an organization in California called the Price-Pottinger Nutrition Foundation, and they have the mandate to keep the book in print. They are less of an activist organization compared to ours, but they have done a very good job of, you know, keeping this in print, which was, you know, what its mission was.
Okay, you mentioned another name who's also a very famous guy, Pottinger, and the so-called Pottinger cats. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So Pottinger was an allergist in Southern California, and he was a very busy practice, and he was looking for, you know, what supports good health. And he had cats, and what he did was feed cats different diets, and not just look at them for a few months, but he followed them over four or five generations. The cats that got all raw food, raw meat, raw milk, and cod liver oil, reproduced normally and were healthy generation after generation. But the cats that had either cooked meat or pasteurized milk became sick in the next generation, they were sicker in the next generation, and by the fourth generation, they died out. They didn't have normal reproduction, and their personalities changed also. So he came to the conclusion, first of all, he was a big advocate for raw milk, as we are, and he just came to the conclusion that the diet affects each generation more severely if it's a poor diet. Now, and so let me just add, we do have a second website. It's realmilk.com, which advocates raw milk, raw whole milk from pastured cows. And when we first started that website, which was also in 1999, it was shocking to most people. You know, we were, you know, it's like, what are you trying to do, poison us all and kill everybody with raw milk? Since that time, we've seen some grudging acceptance because we have shown the data, which indicates that raw milk is actually very safe. And we've shown the science showing that the pasteurization really does lower the nutritional value of milk, which is a wonderful food.
So did Dr. Price know Dr. Pottinger?
They did know each other. Pottinger was much younger than Dr. Price. So,
and this organization that is dedicated to both keeping both books in print. Is that a coincidence that they both kind of had the same philosophy, or how?
Yes, and the people who started that foundation knew both doctors. Yes, so they knew them, and after they died, they collected up their papers and archived them.
Okay, so you guys really are radicals. I mean, you know, when you we're going to go over now what a good diet is, because what I tell people is, Weston Price represents what I think is the best approach towards food and the best possible diet that you could eat. The only thing that we had a little bit of a disagreement about was chocolate, which I want you to take a minute actually right now to tell me, why shouldn't you eat chocolate?
Well, it's not the worst addiction you could have. Chocolate's addictive. It's got addictive alkaloids in it that raise dopamine, just like sugar does and just like drugs do. And you can have side effects, withdrawal symptoms, which very often manifest as anger and rage. We see a lot of rage in this country. And chocolate's also very sweet. Even dark chocolate contains about 3 tablespoons of sugar per bar. That's a lot of sugar. And it's full of caffeine. My biggest concern about chocolate's being given to kids. This is not a good idea to give kids a mind-altering, addictive substance.
Mind-adulterating.
Yeah, addictive substance. And yet everyone thinks it's fine to give chocolate to kids. And I must say, the chocolate marketing organization has done a superb job of creating the impression that chocolate's healthy. Chocolate sales really went down in the 1970s because people were becoming more health conscious. They were trying to stay away from sugar and so forth. And what the industry did was fund a lot of studies and put them out there to the public as though to say that chocolate's really healthy, full of magnesium, et cetera, et cetera. And when you actually look at those studies, they're extremely flimsy. But they were very clever. And the chocolate sales have come back up, and you have free trade chocolate and organic chocolate and fermented chocolate. And then they use a fancy name like cacao. You know, I've had people say to me, oh, I don't eat chocolate, I eat cacao. Well, it's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. Now, I'm not going around to people saying, oh, you mustn't eat that chocolate. What I am saying is that eventually, as we get healthy and eat the right fats and get the nutrients in our body that we need, suddenly you're going to find that you actually don't want that chocolate. You don't want those cookies in the supermarket. You don't want that soda. Even the idea of eating them makes you a little bit nauseous to think about it. That's the goal. So that you can avoid eating these things, not through willpower. Willpower never works when you're addicted, you know, but through a sense of, oh, I just don't want this stuff. I'd rather eat something else.
So what I tell people is, because we have such experience as hunter-gatherers, and we have a basically almost a genetic-based understanding of traditional diet and what's good for us, if we're able to get ourselves clean, our body will kind of tell us what we need. Unfortunately, probably 90-95% of the food in the supermarket is not something that you should be eating. So what do you think about that? What do you think about that approach?
I'm not sure I would put it that way. The traditional people, first of all, they had no choice in what they ate. What was there was what they ate. But they also had an instinct that certain foods were good for certain things, that the liver was good for babies or nursing women or whatever. They had an instinct. It was a type of consciousness that we've lost. They could tap into the spiritual world. I really believe that's how they knew these things. You would ask them, why do you eat liver? Well, they just laugh at you. I mean, don't you know? I mean, it's obvious, right? And we've completely lost that. That is the process of civilization, civilizing you. You lose the sense that there's a spiritual world out there. People become completely materialistic. They say that world doesn't exist anymore or never did. And so now we have to come to things through science. And science is a very bad bedfellow because science can be wrong. Lots of times it's wrong. And now we have to think about every morsel of food that we put in our mouths. It's not instinctual anymore. Because now, as civilized people, we're developing what Rudolf Steiner called the mental body, the spiritual body. So food is a big challenge for modern man. And we have to figure out what's healthy. Because we don't know. The primitive person just knew, and we don't know. So what we say is, let's look at how primitive people ate, how they prepared their foods, what they chose to eat, their rituals around food, and see if we can find the scientific validation for that. And when we have the scientific validation of these traditional foodways, then we're pretty assured that we're on the right path.
Now, do you have a background in science? What is your background?
My background is in English, but I must say my father believe that all girls should take math and physics. So the girls in our family had to take math and physics just like the boys. He was just insistent on that. So I did have a background in the physical sciences in high school.
But you partnered with somebody that actually was a biochemist,
yes,
right?
Yes.
To write your book.
Yes, right. I never did much biology.
There's something called here on your site, there's wonderful things on your site, Principles of Healthy Diets. And it's quite long, and it's a great summary of history of Price and basically all the fundamental principles and ideas of the Weston A. Price Foundation. So here's a few things. Characteristics of traditional diets. The diets of healthy, non-industrialized peoples contain no refined or denatured foods or ingredients such as refined sugar or high fructose corn syrup, white flour, canned foods, pasteurized, homogenized, skim or low-fat milk, refined or hydrogenated vegetable oils, protein powders, synthetic vitamins or toxic additives, and artificial colorings. I guess we could add GMOs to that, too.
Yes, we could. Yes, yes.
All traditional cultures consume some sort of animal food such as fish and shellfish, land and waterfowl, land and sea mammals, eggs, milk and milk products, reptiles, and insects. The whole animal is consumed, muscle, meat, organs, bones, and fat, with the organ meats and fats preferred. By the way, people say, hey, no milk. I mean, adult humans don't need dairy products. You need it as a kid, but you don't need it after, you know, 2 or 3 years old. What's your feeling on that?
The cultures that had the dairy products were some of the healthiest that he saw, and anthropologists are in agreement that having herd animals was an advantage, evolutionary advantage to these people because they had such nutrient-dense foods all year long. Of course, we have this view, and I think it's correct, that milk is harmful, it causes allergies, stomach problems, autoimmune disease, and pasteurized milk definitely does. It is a harmful food, and it's why people have come to the conclusion that they don't need milk, it's not good for them.
So ultra-pasteurized is even more ultra-damaging.
Yes, ultra-pasteurized milk is completely dead, and you know it is because you can't make cheese with it. Cheese is a process of digestion. You can make cheese with pasteurized milk, but you absolutely cannot make cheese with ultra-pasteurized milk, and that tells you that it is indigestible.
So here is an irony, because I went to Organic Valley and Horizon, these people, when they're at food shows, and I said, you know, here you went through all this effort to get an organic product, and then you ultra-pasteurize it for the industry. You've just now turned, it destroyed so much of the nutritional content, but probably have turned it into quite a harmful food in the process. And they said, yeah, we know we're trying to find another way, but we don't know another way around it.
I've had exactly the same discussion with them. Exactly the same discussion. And I think for a while they were trying to do a more local pasteurized milk. But I said, you guys need to pioneer raw milk. You can do it on a large scale. Our children need this milk. But there's not as much profit in selling whole raw milk. Because see, what the milk industry does, they actually take milk apart. They get the protein part, the fat part, the sugar part sometimes, and then they kind of put it back together. But when they put it back together, they don't put all the fat back in. So even full fat milk is only 3% fat, whereas real milk is 5 to 6% fat. And the fat that's left over, they've figured out that they can make more profit on that butter fat or cream by doing ice cream. And so what they want is for everyone to drink skim milk and eat ice cream. And that's exactly what happens. If you're eating skim milk and low-fat foods all day long, by time evening comes around, your body is so starving for fats that you go to the freezer and take out a half a gallon of ice cream and eat the whole thing standing up right there in front of the freezer. Okay. That's what happens. They know that, and that's what they want you to do because there's more money in it that way. So now we have this terrible situation where school children, they can't have whole milk anymore in the schools. And they get highly reduced fat milk, or they get low-fat chocolate milk or strawberry milk.
There's a lot of sugar in it.
A lot of sugar. There's more sugar in these milks than there is in soda. And with the chocolate, they're getting caffeine. They are highly sweetened. The protein in these milks has been powdered, so it's highly denatured and allergenic. You could not think of anything worse to give to growing children. But that's what we do, and it's for higher profits.
The diets of healthy, non-industrialized peoples contain at least 4 times the minerals and water-soluble vitamins and 10 times the fat-soluble vitamins found in animal fats, vitamin A, D, and activator X, which is now considered K2, as the average American diet. The traditional cultures cook some of their food, but all consumed a portion of their animal foods raw. Primitive and traditional diets have a high content of food enzymes and beneficial bacteria from lacto-fermented vegetables, fruits, beverages, dairy products, meats, and condiments. Seeds, grains, and nuts are soaked, sprouted, fermented, or naturally leavened to neutralize naturally occurring anti-nutrients such as enzyme inhibitors, tannins, and phytic acid. Let's talk for a second about these enzyme inhibitors, because one of the problems with eating some seeds is the fact that it's a seed because there's enzymes in there that prevent it from basically growing, right?
Exactly. The seeds are designed to go through an animal intact. They are indigestible. And we have this situation today where people are intolerant of grains, especially wheat and the gluten in wheat. And it's getting worse and worse. And I have to say, I spoke to someone at Kellogg's 20 years ago. And they were trying to see how they could monetize what I had done. I said, you need to soak these grains. I said, what's going to happen is more and more people are going to become intolerant of grains, and you're going to lose business. And they laughed at me, you know. They didn't want to talk to me. Well, this is what's happened, because in traditional cultures, they treated grains with great respect. Sometimes they were soaked or soured for up to 2 weeks to make them digestible. In Africa, they made these beers out of sorghum and other grains that were extremely sour. In fact, they were less than a 4 pH. They kind of smelled like barf. I mean, they're very sour, but extremely nourishing. And the other thing that happens when you soak the grains, you're not only neutralizing all these harmful substances like phytic acid and lectins and everything, but you are releasing the minerals and you create a lot of B vitamins. So we get back to this concept of nutrient density. Grains are not particularly nutrient dense until you soak them or make the sourdough bread. And that process of fermentation makes them a nutrient dense food.
So when I go to the health food store and get a whole bag of sunflower seeds, it's not the best thing I'm supposed to be doing.
No, you shouldn't be chewing on sunflower seeds. They're going to go right through you anyway, and they're hard to digest.
And from an evolutionary perspective, they go through because the animal is actually a conveyor of that seed to other territory.
That's how they spread. Yeah, that's their strategy. If you want to make something with seeds, usually the seeds are pounded and soaked in some way to make a kind of mayonnaise-like product or a dip or something. A lot of cultures did these kind of things with seeds.
So if I eat sunflower seed butter, is that better or is it still a problem?
Again, that's better. It's definitely better. But again, you would want to somehow ferment it. And I'm not saying I know how to do that. But yeah, now nuts. The nuts we recommend soaking in salt water because salt water neutralizes a lot of these things. And then you dehydrate them in an oven, and what you get at the end is a really delicious nut. It brings out the flavors, it makes them really crispy, and you don't get the allergic reactions that a lot of people get to nuts. We call those crispy nuts.
Total fat content of traditional diets varies from 30 to 80% of calories, but only about 4% of calories come from polyunsaturated oils, naturally occurring in grains, legumes, nuts, fish, animal fats, and vegetables. The balance of fat calories is in the form of saturated and monounsaturated fatty acids. Traditional diets contain nearly equal amounts of omega-6 and omega-3 essential fatty acids. All traditional diets contain some salt. All traditional cultures make use of animal bones, usually in the form of gelatin-rich bone broths. So we go down the list here, And what we're finding out is you guys are almost on the opposite side of the food pyramid in a lot of ways, opposite side of what FDA, USDA, AMA have been preaching for the last 30 to 40 years. Low salt, lean meats, pasteurized milk only, reduced whole dairy grains, products.
Whole grains, rough whole grains.
Right, yeah. Rough whole grains. And
no salt. Yeah.
So how did all those guys, with all those PhDs and everything else, how did they get it so wrong? Or did they get it right for all the purposes?
They got it wrong because they're materialistic. They're not thinking in the right way. They think science is going to solve everything. And I can't think of a better example of how dangerous it is to trust science than to look at the ingredients in infant formula. Okay? This is supposed to be the best that science can do. And what's in infant formula? Powdered skim milk, vegetable oils,
soy products,
sugar or high fructose corn syrup instead of lactose, which is what's in human milk, artificial vitamins and everything. That's what science has given us. And if you think science is wonderful, that's what you're going to end up with. Truly toxic brew that they think is okay for children. Where were we?
Well, the point is that science can synthesize, the world better than nature can, who's been at it for 4 billion years on this planet.
Well, they think that nature happened, it all happened by chance, and mistakes happened. And what they're going to do is fix the mistakes. That's what they really, really think. But you were talking about how our message is contrary to what everybody else has said. However, we actually are in the forefront of all the new trends in nutrition, whether people realize it or not. Broth is a really big thing now. Broth is the new juice. And there's all kinds of books on broth and people promoting broth. Very few of them realize that all this started with the Weston A. Price Foundation. Same with soaking grains, sourdough bread, fermented foods, butter. All of this started with us. But most people don't realize it when they promote these things because it's out there now. It's in the culture. People are picking up on kombucha, which is a lacto-fermented beverage. They're eating sauerkraut, soaking their grains. So that's all started with the Weston A. Price Foundation.
And when we were having lunch, I told you you were one of my heroes. And I was explaining to somebody next to me that you are really in the forefront, one of the pioneers for what I call an intelligent approach, which is basically being respectful of a traditional approach. Yes. to wonderful whole foods.
I also think that our diet is, there's no renunciation in our diet. You can have meat, you can have fat, you can have sauces. Sauces are healthy in our diet. They're made with bone broth and cream. You can have butter, you can have eggs, you can have fats, you can have pickles, you can have healthy soft drinks, you can have salt. You can have it all in our diet. You're not giving up anything. It actually so satisfying, this diet, that your cravings go away. So sitting down to a meal, what we call a Wise Traditions meal, is a relaxing, healthy, pleasurable thing to do. Whereas what the dietary guidelines have done have created a kind of a curse with our food. I mean, the way they want you to eat is impossible to eat. You can't stay on that low-fat, high-fiber diet, low-salt, high fiber, low.
Your body revolts on you.
And so what happens is, I like to say that people are eating the puritanical diet, and they think it's going to make them healthy and I don't know, spiritual, I don't know what they think. And then they get such cravings that it pushes them to the pornographic foods, see? The pornographic junk foods. And so people are pushed back and forth between the puritanical and the pornographic. That's exactly what they want.
I think it's actually quite a good metaphor for modern life.
Yeah, it is. It is truly a metaphor for modern life. And we need to learn that the healthy way of life is neither of those things. It's just good old-fashioned nourishing foods with plenty of fat, enjoyed, savored, and family meals.
But can I look like a Vogue model on your diet?
Probably not. But you will look good. You will look good. You won't be super thin, but you won't be real overweight either. A lot of boys brought up in this diet are quite husky. They're masculine. And the women are quite curvaceous. They're feminine. Way too curvaceous for the modern look, you know, which is kind of hermaphroditic, you know, just straight women, you know, no curves.
Yeah, and so we want to make everybody sexually equal too, you know, exactly. in the new world order. So here's a few dietary guidelines again. Eat whole, unprocessed foods. Eat beef, lamb, game, organ meats, poultry, and eggs from pasture-fed animals. Eat wild fish, not farm-raised. Fish, eggs, and shellfish from unpolluted waters. Eat full-fat milk products from pasture-fed cows, preferably raw and or fermented, such as raw milk, whole yogurt, kefir, cultured butter, full-fat raw cheeses, and fresh and sour cream. Use animal fats such as lard, tallow, egg yolks, cream, and butter liberally. Use only traditional vegetable oils, extra virgin olive oil, expeller pressed sesame oil, small amounts of expeller expressed flax oil. Tell me about that, because flax oil is the big thing. So why just a little bit?
So flax oil is a wonderful source of omega-3 fatty acids. And by the way, speaking of being on the forefront, we were the first organization to talk about the need for this balance between omega-6 and omega-3. And when you're eating a lot of junk food, you're getting mostly omega-6 and hardly any omega-3. Well, you know how Americans are. They always overdo things. And what happened was that people started to overdo on the fish oils and the flax oil to get their omega-3. And that too much omega-3 is just as bad as too much omega-6. One of the things you get in with too much omega-3 is food intolerances and skin problems. So we just had to warn people, you know, you can put a tiny little bit of a flax oil in your salad dressing to get those omega-3s, but, you know, don't overdo.
And, wow, look at this. Tropical oils, coconut oil, palm oil, and palm kernel oil. That's good for you, too.
Those are good oils. Those are really good, healthy, saturated oils.
Take cod liver oil regularly to provide at least 10,000 IU vitamin A and 1,000 IU vitamin D. What's the minimal daily requirements according to our good buddies at the AMA and so on?
I think it's 3,000 A, and I think it's about 1,000 D. I'm not sure what the D is right now. And what we have right now is people avoiding vitamin A, so they're hardly getting any vitamin A, and they're taking vitamin D supplements, so they're getting 3,000 to 5,000 units of vitamin D per day. This is a very dangerous practice, and it can lead to calcification of the arteries and all sorts of problems.
Yeah, but I live where there's a lot of sun, so I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. When you're in a lot of sun, what you have to worry about is getting enough vitamin A, because lifeguards, for example, are very prone to kidney stones, which is a sign of vitamin A deficiency. You need these two vitamins in balance. A and D work together along with vitamin K, and that's why we stress that you need to get them from food where they usually all occur in the same foods. So that's why we like cod liver oil. It's not a vitamin, it's a food. And there's certain brands that we recommend that are naturally extracted without heat. And so everything is preserved in the cod liver oil.
Okay, so, but I take it my one-a-day synthetic vitamin tablet every day, so I don't have to worry about any of this stuff.
Well, that's what they'd have, like you have to believe. And of course, there's artificial colors. It's usually MSG in those tablets. And there's no vitamin A anymore. There used to be, but now it's carotenes. It's only vitamin D3. There's 1,000 forms of vitamin D, 1,000. And you would get those in cod liver oil, but you're not going to get that on your vitamin pill. And there's all sorts of other problems. The form of B12 that's in those vitamins, the form of folic acid, the folic acid rather than the folate.
let me mention something too. A lot of these vitamins, the synthetic processes, use GMOs as feeder stocks for these processes, and also other genetically modified processes.
Yes. The first genetically modified organisms were actually bacteria to make what they call vegetarian rennet for cheese. And a lot of vitamins are made with these genetically modified organisms in China, so there's very little quality control.
So vegetarian rennet, instead of natural rennet that comes from stomach lining, ends up being something problematic. But listen,
The way forward is to become a vegan. Everybody knows it because, you know, after
spiritual,
all...
It's spiritual, right?
Well, it's, you know, the low carbon footprint, the whole thing, and also instead of raising vegetables and grains that we feed to animals, let's just eat... It's much more efficient to eat just the grains and the vegetables.
Unfortunately, I know a lot of people think that. They think that it's more environmentally friendly and more spiritual just to eat... plant foods, but what happens, and they often feel better at first, but what happens is over time, very serious deficiencies develop. You can't get vitamin A from plant foods, you can't get B12, you can't get enough protein, balanced protein, vitamin D, vitamin K, B6, zinc, you'll be definitely become deficient in zinc, which makes it hard to think straight, and a lot of other nutrients, these deficiencies start to show up. You know, we need to accept where we are. We're in the earth, we're in physical bodies, and these bodies need animal foods, especially during that period of growth. And there are some pretty alarming studies of what happens to children who grow up on low animal food diets, low fat or vegetarian vegan diets, that you see short stature, retarded intellectual development, bone problems, rickets, and it is just not fair to bring a child into the world on that kind of diet.
There's, you know, quite a few things here under these guidelines, and I just want to mention a few others, but I would really recommend to the subscribers that they spend some time on your wonderful site.
Let me just say, if you email the foundation or call us, we have a brochure, it's about 24 pages long, that is I call it the most subversive document on the planet. And we put all of our principles and key findings in this brochure. And we were having a meeting yesterday and our executive director said, you know, we really need to read this brochure every year because it's all there. It's really packed. And once you understand what's in this brochure, you'll understand what we're about. So you can call and we'll send you a brochure.
But it's also online, right? You can download it?
Yes, it is online. Or you can press a button that says, send us your info pack and you'll get the brochure. And, a pretty persuasive letter, hoping that you'll become a member.
And we're going to have that as in the link at the end of the seminar, so that you can just click on it and go right to that. But here's a few other things: use filtered water for cooking and drinking. You know, when I talk to my supermarket clients, yeah. I say to them, "Hey, what's one of the most important ingredients you have in here?" And nobody ever guesses, it's the water.
Yes.
So we have fluoridated water, we have chlorinated water, we have water with all kinds of other contaminants in the damn thing, and it's one of the most important ingredients, and it's one of the most overlooked.
And they're spraying that water on the vegetables all the time. Yeah, nobody thinks about that. Yes, so our water is fluoridated. Fluoride is a poison. It is a poison to a lot of enzymes in your body. And the fluoride they're using now is... fluorosilicic acid, which is a really toxic waste product from the fertilizer industry, that goes into the water. And the chloramines, now they used to put chloride in the water, which would evaporate off. And to prevent that evaporation, they now use chloramines. So the chloride is always in there. And there's, who knows, our water supply is polluted with statin drugs, birth control pills,
antibiotics,
hormones, as all goes into the water, you know, the urine upstream, all those drugs end up in the water. So it really is very important to have a little home filter system in your kitchen.
Cook only in stainless steel, cast iron, glass, or good quality enamel.
Yeah, no aluminum. Now, what's interesting to me is in the restaurants and the delis and all that, they cook in these big aluminum pans. The public can't even buy those pans, you know, because they don't want them. But that's what's being used for so much of our food preparation.
So what I will tell you is, as I look down the list of what you guys recommend, I do basically everything that you recommend, except chocolate, because I was allergic to chocolate for so long. And then I found this amazing chocolate out of San Francisco called Dandelion that has only two ingredients. But like you said, 70% chocolate has 30% sugar.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Plus all these addictive, because people absolutely, you even hear people proclaim the addictiveness of chocolate, and that's one of the things that they like, yes, along with coffee, of course, and caffeine. And chocolate has caffeine.
Yeah, chocolate has caffeine. And it's especially inappropriate for growing children. You don't want to give stimulants to growing children. You know, they used to say coffee stunts your growth, and it's stimulating the adrenal glands all the time, and yes, that could stunt your growth.
It's interesting that chocolate is supposed to be allergic for an allergen for dogs.
Oh, is that right? Yes.
Yeah, so maybe dogs know something that we... So you have a little farm, don't you? You live in where, Maryland?
We live in Southern Maryland, and a few years ago, my husband and I committed the ultimate folly of buying a farm. And we do we have a pasture-based dairy farm. We make raw cheese, completely natural raw cheese with animal rennet. We make it the old-fashioned way. We also sell raw milk. We have to label it as pet milk. And we sell pastured beef, pork that we feed whey from the cheese to the pork, and raised in our woods. And we have chickens, eggs, and turkeys, and a lot of these other products in our store. We have bone broth and lacto-fermented foods, right salt. We try to sell everything that we recommend.
I think it's a reason to move to Southern Maryland.
Yes, it is.
But the USDA guys that are around there, they have a lot of respect for what you're doing and are great supporters, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, unfortunately not. Actually, we were told that our farm is giving agriculture a bad name. So they really don't like what we're doing. They don't like the rotational grazing. They say that's too much work. I, of course, have been very critical of soy. We advertise that we don't use any soy, any corn, any GMOs. And, of course, that does give agriculture a bad name.
So I'm glad you mentioned soy, because that's another one. So tell me why we shouldn't be eating soy or very little of it.
You know, talking about being in the forefront, we were the first organization to warn the public about soy, and we really spoiled their party, because the soy industry had been geared up for $8 billion a year in sales, and they were aiming it at the upscale yuppie market concerned about their health. I mean, I'm quoting directly from a soy industry document. And we pointed out that soy is highly estrogenic, that it depresses thyroid function, is extremely hard to digest, and the sales just plummeted for them. They never got to that $8 billion. They're at about $4 billion, and most of that soy is going into institutional food. So 30% of your child's hamburger in public schools, school lunches, is soy. So you're giving highly estrogenic foods to growing children. In prisons, the diet is 70% soy. And this is absolutely ruining these men. They will never be able to be useful citizens when they get out. They're all going to go on disability because they cannot function after being poisoned with this soy. They get terrible digestive problems. They grow breasts. They get thyroid problems, and they can't think anymore, can't work. They don't have any energy. And so this is a big, large-scale genocidal experiment going on in our prisons, and they can see very well what it does.
But it seems like most of what the official bodies have been telling us to do is almost borders on genocide, too, doesn't it?
It is genocidal. The low-fat diet is genocidal. And we know from animal studies, we know from the science, after three generations, you won't have any more reproduction.
Is this a plan?
I think at the very top, you mean, do I think that there's evil men in three-piece suits sitting in wood-paneled rooms thinking, how can we destroy humanity?
But they actually know that these things will depopulate us, will dehumanize us.
Well, my answer to that is yes. I do think that at the very top, there are people who know these things, and they've actually stated, we're going to reduce the world's population by, I think, 90%. That's what they want to do. This is how they're going to do it. I was talking to a gal this morning at the conference. Did you know that sunscreen contains a substance that completely blocks testosterone. It's not just estrogenic, it blocks testosterone. And we have schools in California where the children are not allowed to go out and play unless this stuff is spread on their skin. This is genocide. But I don't think all the people involved know that. You know, they're what Lenin called useful idiots. They just believe what they're told, do what they're told, hope to make some money, you know.
I think Reich referred to some of these guys as petty tyrants.
Yeah, little Hitlers. But you can only love them and forgive them. And I always say these people are trapped in a system, and the only way that you are going to get them out of that trap is not to eat their food. You're not going to change the laws at the top. You're not going to convince the Secretary of Agriculture. You're not going to, you know, stop the juggernaut of the pharmaceutical companies. The only way that you can do it is say, no, I'm not going to eat this food. I'm not going to take these drugs. Just no. And it has to be one person at a time.
Sally, you're an amazing person, astonishingly dedicated. You're running a very successful conference, a tremendous resource for everybody in terms of how to connect with real food with your WestonAPrice.org site. Your books, you've written quite a few books, and tell us about a few of those.
Well, my first book was Nourishing Traditions, and I had to set up a little company to publish it because no one would publish it. And we're almost at 800,000 copies of Nourishing Traditions sold now. With another publisher, I wrote Nourishing Broth and Nourishing Fats. And I have another book coming out next year, Nourishing Diet. So I've kind of quartered nourishing. And then I also published the Nourishing Traditions book of baby and child care, the Nourishing Traditions cookbook for children, and a really beautiful book I love called The Fourfold Path to Healing. I also published a book on the dangers of soy foods, and I published a book on milk, The Untold Story of Milk.
Have all these been done in partnership with Dr. Mary Enig?
No, it was just the first one that I did with her. And also, Eat Fat, Lose Fat was a book on coconut oil, using coconut oil for weight loss, and she and I wrote that together.
I really appreciate this opportunity. I have told you I paid to come to the Weston Price Conference 3 or 4 times. This is the first one I've actually attended, and it's a remarkable event. I would encourage people to join your organization, support your efforts, and eat in a way that keeps us free,
keeps
us healthy,
and
keeps
happy.
Us sane.
And happy, yes. And by the way, the food at our conferences is wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, and thank you for the work that you're doing. We appreciate that as well. Thank you.